This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. It is time to discuss this past week's important news with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Anthony Chabaterwe.
Hello.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
There is a disaster playing out over a huge swath of the midsection of America. Farms, towns, nearly entire states underwater. A disaster with troubling long-term ramifications. We talked about this on Wednesday's program, but considering how little press it is getting elsewhere, I thought it would be worth focusing on this to begin today's program as well. For this story, we will turn to Andrew.
Yeah, over a million acres of U.S. farmland are now underwater or have been underwater in the very recent past. This is the worst agricultural disaster in modern U.S. history. And amazingly, one of the most underreported stories in the American news media right now. I didn't find out about it till about a week ago, even though this has been happening for close to a month now. Mm-hmm. Just kind of, I mean, I'm sure news agencies have done their articles on it. When I started looking for them, you find them, but they're definitely not on the front page of any of the normal news sites Americans are consuming, which is, like I said, shocking just by how big a deal this is, just due to the winter up in the Midwest. A lot of the ground's been cold and frozen. And then about 3 weeks ago, they had what they called a bomb cyclone, with just this deluge of rain, which would have been bad at any time, but especially bad in the midst of winter when the ground is frozen like this, because the ground's not absorbing water like it normally does. It's just cascading down these states adjacent to the Mississippi and Ohio rivers. Nebraska and Iowa hit much of the brunt of this. And so, I mean, highways washed out, people stranded on like islands where their house has been surrounded by water, bridges washed out. So a lot of the normal and horrific problems that come with a natural disaster. But unlike some of the other big natural disasters of recent times, like Hurricane Harvey or Hurricane Maria that have hit urban centers on the coast, this is right in the heart of America's breadbasket. So they're still tallying the damage. They're thinking that it's probably about $3 billion worth of damage so far from this. And a third of that, about $1 billion, is into agricultural production. Farms that have can't be sown with crops because they're underwater. Soybeans and grain and corn that have been stored in silos on people's farms that are now moldy and rotten because they've been washed out with water. Some livestock death, but probably even more significant than that is like livestock feed. A lot of these grains that are being destroyed were earmarked for livestock feed that's going to affect the livestock market coming up. They're estimating that over the next several months, beef prices at your local supermarket could be 25 to 50 cents higher per pound due to the loss in cattle production that's going to come from this flood. I haven't seen official statistics on what's going to happen to the grain market yet, but there's been so many thousands of pounds of grain destroyed that there's got to be an uptick in those prices as well.
Yeah, it's really amazing how many different sectors and how much this will affect for Americans all across the country. It might take a little bit of time, but you can definitely see how this would really affect grocery prices over the coming months and possibly beyond that. Looking into this myself for that story on Wednesday, the other thing that struck me was just how much damage is being done to the soils that could affect production for many years to come.
Right. Yeah, you get erosion and things like that that can have huge ramifications. These, like I said, this is right along the Mississippi River, so things get swept out into the Mississippi, that fertile topsoil that's so important to farming. You get that first couple inches that it actually doesn't take much. It doesn't take much to wash away. We know that well here in Oklahoma. They used to have topsoil here at one point in history. I've read about, but I think all blew to California in the Dust Bowl, so we're just left with the red clay that's normally about a foot underground on everywhere else in the United States.
But, right. So when I talked about this on Wednesday on the Trumpet Hour and wrote an article about it, I kind of focused on the general point about just blessings and curses that result from our obedience or disobedience. Agriculture, production, certainly one of the specific things that the Bible prophesies is contingent on our righteousness. You had some other thoughts about this that I'd like you to focus on.
Right, because there is that more general prophecy in Leviticus 26 about, like, if you obey my laws, I'll give you rain in due season and agricultural prosperity. If you disobey my laws, you won't get rain in due season and you won't have agricultural prosperity. But for the America in particular, which the longtime listeners of this show will have hopefully read Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, mentioned that America is descended from the ancient nations of Israel. So there's specific prophecies in the Bible about how God is going to take away the agricultural prosperity in the end time. One of those specific prophecies in Ezekiel 5 and verse 12 talks about a third of you shall die with the pestilence, and with famine they shall be consumed in the midst of you. And so that's just talking about this horrific famine. I mean, this is like Ukrainian Holodomor level famine, where I think 25% of the population died in that famine. Here it's talking about like 33%, even more than that, as close as I could come up with, dying in this this horrendous famine that consumes America and Britain, a famine and pestilence. And I know Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong had written a lot over the years about especially like drought and flood would be a cause of this famine that kills a third of the population. Now, in our Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet booklet written by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, he does focus more on how that word pestilence comes before the famine, and it has a connotation of like rioting and burning, and he's put probably more emphasis than even Mr. Armstrong did on the fact that like civil war, race riots, terrorism, mm-hmm. urban riots, things that are going to like break gas lines, break sewage systems, disrupt transportation routes can cause the famine. But as you mentioned in Wednesday's show too, there's plenty of other prophecies about natural disasters that undoubtedly would kind of play a role in this perfect storm that, it's not just agricultural mistakes or fossil fuel mistakes or ways to make cattle that's causing this. This is actually, you mentioned Leviticus 26, that God cursing a nation because of rebellion against his laws. So you kind of get this perfect storm of like floods in the Midwest and droughts out in California and violence in cities across the nation that escalates into a point where you actually can't find food anymore. Something like this just shows that a very underreported story where, I mean, a million acres of land gets flooded in the space of a couple weeks, and now all of a sudden beef prices are 50 cents higher than they used to be, and mm-hmm. and the grain market's taken a huge hit. I mean, it's America's a first world country, this particular flood. I mean, we'll recover from it, but it does just show how easy mm-hmm. it is for a prophecy like that to be fulfilled when God's cursing a nation, and he controls the weather.
Yeah, you could see these types of disasters contributing to the conditions that are described. It's really hard. You read Ezekiel 5 and the way that Gerald Fleury explains that prophecy to imagine how serious that will be when that unfolds. And you would imagine that there would be several factors contributing to that. This certainly could be one of them. We might be looking at a preview of more disasters to come. Well, we appreciate that. We will put links to those two booklets that Andrew spoke about in the show notes, United States and Britain in Prophecy and Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet. We'll also put the link to the article that went up this week, Midwest Floods, Worst Agricultural Disaster in Modern U.S. History. Go check that out on thetrumpet.com. And thank you, Andrew. Massive protests in Algeria got results this week as the country's ruler, Abdelaziz Bouteflika, stepped down. What does this mean for the country's future? For the answer, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
A good question, but it has lots of ominous potentialities, to borrow a phrase from Mr. Armstrong. So you had certainly hundreds of thousands, perhaps even a million, depending on which reports you follow, taking to the streets last Friday. That was the culmination of about 6 weeks of protests calling for Algeria's longtime strongman to go. So, and that's a significant event. Algeria is a country that has had some serious problems with radical Islam. They had what they called the dark decade during the 90s, where there was a civil war largely fought against radical Islamists, where around 200,000 people died. And then Bouteflika came in, Abdelaziz Bouteflika became president and really brought a lot of peace and stability. Now, he's certainly not democratic. He was running for his fifth term. It was his announcement that he was going to run for his fifth term that triggered these protests. Also, he's probably not been the one that's been doing a lot of the actual running. He had a stroke 4 or 5 years ago, and there's various different reports as to exactly how capable he is of really doing anything much. At this point, he may well just be a figurehead. But even so, this man and the regime behind him has kept the radical Islamists out of Algeria, at least out of the main part of Algeria. They still had big flare-ups. There was that massive hostage taking where they took about 700 people hostage at a natural gas plant back in, I think, 2013. So you've had this country that is a potential to explode. Abdelaziz Bouteflika and those behind him have been the ones keeping the lid on this, stopping this from exploding. Now he's gone. Now he's announced, he's announced that he is resigning. Now, that resignation came backed by the army. The army sided with the protesters and helped push him out, probably because they want to try and retain control. But you've still now got this potentially explosive situation in Algeria. A lot of people are now watching it, saying, well, he's gone. This is the opportunity that the radical Islamists have been waiting for years. Are they going to be able to take advantage of it? And if they do, if you have some kind of radical Islamist uprising in Algeria, that has massive implications for Europe. Algeria is a major oil and natural gas hub. Spain gets about half of their natural gas from Algeria. They're Europe's third largest natural gas supplier. So it's important for Europe's economy. But even more importantly, look at the migrant crisis and what that did to Europe when you had Syria implode. Well, you could have with Algeria an even larger country implode. Then that could further destabilize just about all of North Africa, as terrorists could use that as a base to make Libya worse, to make Nigeria worse, to make Niger worse, to make Mali worse. You've got the prospect of if this falls apart, one analyst estimated maybe 10 to 15 million Algerians, throw in all of those others that could be coming from North Africa, and you could have a wave of migrants heading towards Europe that dwarfs what we saw in Syria. So Europe is watching this, and they're really concerned about this as well. And Algeria has very close cultural links to France. They're a French colony. The language there is kind of a mixture of French and Arabic. So you've got huge potentials for Europe from what's happening now in Algeria, to the point that somebody, I think it was Stephen Pollard in The Spectator a couple of years ago, warning that it could even destroy the EU. this one country and the step down of this one strongman.
So this status quo has been fairly fragilely held together for a while now, and Bouteflika stepping down essentially launches that country forward into an unknown future where you have Islamists on one side and Europeans on the other, with extremely strong vested interests in the future of that nation at play, and a potential proxy war between the two that Gerald Flory has been talking about for quite some time.
That's right. He had an article in the Trumpet magazine back in 2013, just after that hostage crisis, titled "Watch Algeria," where he drew attention to this growing proxy war. And by the way, that proxy war, or these protests against their regime, they haven't ended now that Bouteflika has stepped down. They've still been going on today, demanding more change, saying it's not enough just to have Bouteflika go. We need to have the whole regime to go. So they're still pushing, and there's still the potential, you know, they're still pushing in such a way that could even help the radical Islamists. But yes, everyone's known Bouteflika has been ill for a long time. So this proxy war has been building for a while now. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, everyone's been preparing for it for a while now. You know the radical Islamists that have been growing in power in North Africa, that even this week have been making more gains in Mali, have been preparing for this. At the same time, Algeria, despite being a pretty poor country, is now one of the top oil weapons importers in the world. They are the world's fifth largest arms importer. They've increased their arms imports by 55%. They're looking a lot to Russia, and they're looking a lot to Germany, where they've even got a German arms factory in Algeria churning out a huge number of armored personnel carriers for them. So the military's been beefing up, backed by Europe, in preparation for this. So you can really see this type of proxy war building there. Now you can see this proxy war that we see there really ties right in with Bible prophecy, because the Bible forecasts a clash between exactly these powers in exactly this area. Daniel chapter 11, towards the end of that, around verse 40 to 45, it talks about a European king of the north clashing with the king of the south, radical Islam led by Iran. And you can, in Algeria and in so many of these countries across the Middle East, you see that clash building. That prophecy even talks about very specific areas in North Africa. Libya is mentioned, Ethiopia, Egypt. They're mentioned as being on the side of radical Islam. So when this clash fully breaks out, that's how it's going to divide. But you can see that clash building, and you can see both sides getting ready for that in Algeria right now. And you can, like I said, read more about that with Mr. Flurry's article, Watch Algeria.
Well, we will put a link to that in our show notes. And also, Richard wrote his Trumpet brief on earlier this week on Tuesday about this subject, another million-man march in the Middle East. Even though he wrote that before Bouteflika stepped down, it certainly gives the overview of the subject that you need. We'll put links to both of those in the show notes, and you can check those out at thetrumpet.com. Thank you, Richard. The U.S. military released a report this week putting a number on the fatalities the United States has suffered in Iraq at the hands of Iran. For this, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
So for some time, we have understood that Iran was fighting a proxy war against the United States during the period that the United States had a lot of troops in Iraq ever since 2003 onwards. And there have been unofficial figures as to how many U.S. personnel were killed at the hands of Iranian-backed proxies. And the official figure has come out this week, and that number is 608. Iran actually is at fault for 17% of all U.S. personnel deaths in Iraq. This doesn't include the Iraqi military that was fighting on the behalf of the United States or with the United States for a period, or Iraqi civilians that died at the hands of Iran, just U.S. personnel deaths, not including those that are injured as well. And so this is really significant because it actually puts a figure on what was assumed that there was evidence of Iranian backing, but now we know that 600 U.S. members, service members, were killed directly by Iranian-backed forces.
Looking at this information in light of the Obama administration's approach toward Iran definitely puts that whole policy under the shroud of suspicion, and it really raises your hackles to think about the way that the Obama administration treated Iran at that time. It also seems to just underline the importance of the hardline strategy, the policy that that the Trump administration has taken against Iran. At this point, the United States is fairly isolated in the way that it's approaching Iran, but this does show that definitely it's aimed at more of the center of the target than the previous administration did.
Yeah, I mean, there were rumblings of some type of deal with Iran and the United States even coming in 2011 when Operation Enduring Freedom ended. And so these deaths took place from 2003 to 2011, right on the heels of that. I mean, he could have talked to his anyone from the Pentagon. They would have said, yes, we know that Iran has been behind deaths. The number that was going thrown around at that time was around 500 U.S. personnel. And yet it was chosen to go ahead with some nuclear deal that would allow Iran to receive an economic windfall that would continue to fund an ongoing proxy war against United States interests in the Middle East. And that's what we're seeing. That's what we have seen ever since 2003. If you think about it, going into Iraq, removing Saddam Hussein, as we talked about at the time, the United States removed the number one enemy of Iran and took away one of the greatest obstacles for Iranian hegemony in the Middle East by removing him. Now, I'm not saying there wasn't good reason to do that from the United States perspective, but there was some temporary alliance at that moment with Iranian forces and Iranian-backed forces. But as soon as that danger of Saddam Hussein was removed, you had Iranian forces turn on the United States at that moment. And Qasem Soleimani, again, we've talked about this figure, the head of the Quds Force, he was behind this strategy to take out U.S. personnel to wage this proxy war. Most of these U.S. personnel were killed because we had these roadside bombs that were created in Iran in sophisticated sophisticated engineering feat that actually carried a slug of lead that was so powerful when it exploded, it could penetrate armor, penetrate tanks, penetrate the ATVs, all these vehicles that the U.S. personnel were using could go right through them and shredded U.S. personnel. And the United States knew it at the time. And at the time that this was going on, our editor-in-chief was writing about how it's good and well to go into Iraq, but we're missing the head of the snake. We're missing the head of the terrorist snake. Iran is the number one state sponsor of terrorism, and they are funding terrorism all across the world, and we've just taken away their greatest adversary. And the attention should be on Iran. The United States has been fighting a proxy war against Iran on and off for 20 years almost. And now we are seeing a figure that shows us that Iran has been successful. I mean, these 600 deaths, they were only part of the losses inside Iraq, but it was the way in which American forces were killed by these roadside bombs is what this slow drip of killings is what really did turn the United States civilian population against this war. And so Iran was always funding a war to remove the United States presence from Iraq. And that's what we have seen take place in the Obama years. And even though now we have President Trump turning up the heat on Iran financially, and it looks like it's working, Iran is continuing this policy of domination over Iraq and trying to push out U.S. forces completely.
Well, this certainly does underline what our editor-in-chief has been saying for many years, and pointing to just what a bad actor Iran has been in that theater all along. Wonder just how much the fact that it's coming out as official numbers, whether that will make really any difference, considering the fact that this has pretty well been known all along. But at any rate, You can go online to thetrumpet.com and read the article that Brent was alluding to there. Gerald Flurry wrote in the January 2018 print edition of The Trumpet, the title of that article, America's Greatest Defeat, Iran's Victory. It just details how much the United States has been responsible for the rise of Iran in that region. So we do encourage you to go take a look at that. And thank you very much, Brent. A new study by an American think tank assesses the growing risks of space war and how enemies may use modern space weapons against the United States. For this story, we will turn to Anthony Chibadewe.
Yes, this was a report that I believe was released yesterday by the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and it's titled Space Threat Assessment 2019. And I'm going to read just a good bit out of this report. It says that while vulnerabilities of the United States national security space systems are often discussed publicly, the progress other nations are making in counter space systems is not as readily accessible. The purpose of this report is to review open source information available. It says that its intention is to raise awareness and understanding of the threats, debunking myths and misinformation, and highlight areas in which senior leaders and policymakers should focus their attention. And it said that the biggest threats come from these countries, China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea. But I just thought that I would just focus mostly on China, because China has been a really significant threat. In fact, even just on Wednesday, an FBI official testified and said, he said this. He told lawmakers that China is the most severe counterintelligence threat facing our country. And also the National Interest had an article saying that, you know, in spite of all of that, America is underreacting to the challenges that are posed by China. So I thought that I would read a little bit more about the threat that China is posing in this space war arena. The report said that China shows no signs of slowing its investment in developing counter-space capabilities. Government and military officials often comment on how military space capabilities will ensure their success in conflict and create a significant advantage if China can interfere with the United States' reliance on space architectures.
That's really the crux of it, isn't it?
Yes. And it's easy for people to not really think about space wars because, you know, this is something that's far away. All these satellites that are just so far, it's really growing as a really significant threat. And the foreword to this report was written by Representative Jim Cooper. He's a Democrat from Tennessee. And I thought it was really, really sobering because he really was trying to raise awareness to this threat. He said that we are almost as dependent on satellites as we are on the sun itself. They are our infrastructure of infrastructure, enabling our television, internet, telecommunications, energy, trade, and financial networks to function. He also said that satellites are vulnerable to a wide array of international threats, such as killer satellites. Other nations have learned how to attack the global commons of space. Our vulnerability is acute because our satellites are the juiciest targets. Cripple our satellites and you cripple us. Satellites are not only our crown jewels, but the crown itself, and we have no castle to protect them. The United States is not the leader in anti-satellite technology. We had naively hoped that our satellites were simply out of reach, too high to be attacked, or that other nations would not dare. As this report meticulously documents, other nations are developing, testing, and fielding a range of counter-space weapons that threaten to deprive us of the many economic and military advantages we derive from space. The last bit I'll read here says this: the risk of a space Pearl Harbor is growing every day. Yet this war would not last for years. Rather, it would be over the day it started. Without our satellites, we would have a hard time regrouping and fighting back. We may not even know who attacked us, only that we were deaf, dumb, blind, and impotent.
Mm. So that's obviously a very sobering assessment of the dangers of the threat. Is there any word about what sort of defense that we might have against that, or what actions we might take in order to prevent that from happening?
I haven't read much about what the countermeasures could be. I do assume that the United States has an advanced military and it does have a dominance in space, and I'm sure they are trying to arrange something, but it seems like this caught them a little off guard, or at least the amount of progress that other nations have made. So they are sort of playing catch up, it seems to me. So I'm sure there might be some countermeasures that they are developing, but at the same time, we are seeing really significant threats that are growing, mm-hmm. and there might not be a whole lot that you can do.
Well, it definitely seems like it will play a major role in the next war. And considering how dependent the United States is on those technologies, as you said, there's only so much that you could do, considering the rapid advancement in foreign nations ongoing after that soft target of the United States. You could see that having a significant impact on the next conflict.
Certainly does. In fact, it brings to mind a prophecy that Mr. Gerald Fleury has emphasized and talked about a lot. It's in Ezekiel 7 and verse 14. This is a scripture that talks about the nations of Israel, which includes primarily the United States, sounding the alarm of war, but then no one goes to battle. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Fleury talked about that scripture and asked, is it because we are tagged, our satellites were attacked? Is that the reason why no one goes to battle? And it sounds very similar to this language that's in this report, which says that, you know, we can be attacked, but we just won't know who attacked us. All we will know is that we are deaf, dumb, blind, and impotent. And it just really highlights that scripture in Ezekiel 7, verse 14. And it is a profound subject to think about, and Mr. Fleury has that in an article titled America's Achilles Heel and Germany.
We'll put a link to that in the show notes, and also we have an article up on the website today by Michael Davis that is called Laser Guns in Xinjiang, China's Futuristic Anti-Satellite Weapons, that talks about some of the details of the technology that China is developing. That is up on thetrumpet.com right now. You can check that out. Thank you very much, Anthony. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, NATO's 70th anniversary, Iran creating a missile production facility right on Israel's northern border, a new era for Japan after its emperor abdicates later this month, and America's Category 5 immigration crisis. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Yesterday marked 70 years since the founding of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. This is a good time to remember the purposes for the alliance, to assess just how much has changed since then and what its future will be. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, so NATO's Secretary General and a great deal of other representatives from the alliance met in Washington this week to celebrate the anniversary of this alliance. And U.S. President Donald Trump, he took this opportunity to celebrate in some respects, to celebrate that a lot of NATO countries have upped their military spending the way that he has been pushing them to. And at the same time, he and also Vice President Mike Pence took this opportunity to criticize Germany, who just recently announced that they would be, in fact, cutting their military spending as a percentage of their economy. Currently, they spend around 1.3% of their economy on their military. They're meant to set that to 2%. they've promised that they'll boost that, that they'll hit the 2% target by 2024. But now they're cutting that back. They're heading closer now towards 1.2%. So that was Tuesday, Wednesday, that those individuals were speaking out against what Germany is doing.
So this morning, Stephen Fleury was talking about this poll of Germans that demonstrated their attitude about NATO, about America's role and the alliance with America, and just what their responsibility may be going forward, and how their commitment to the, I guess, the purpose of the alliance. Can you just tell us about that?
Right. That's what's really behind this disagreement that we've seen this week about NATO's military spending and Germany not committing to this alliance. Really, you can see that Germany is already heading off in a different direction. And you saw that with this survey, really showing that their hearts and minds are already in a different direction. The survey found that the majority of Germans are indifferent to NATO. 48% of Germans said that they thought they should not provide military support to a NATO member if Russia attacked it. 48%, and then 28% said they weren't sure. So, you know, the largest bloc was saying we don't want to help a member state. A majority said they were against providing military support to the United States if it were attacked. And that's very different to Britain. That's very different even to France. Even France was in favor of providing help to the United States, but not Germany. They also found that a majority of Germans said that they believe the U.S. to be a greater threat to their security than they believe Russia is.
Mm-hmm.
And this is exactly what you see in Germany's attitude, that they're more and more shifting to align with Russia. You've got this pipeline deal that we've talked about a fair bit on this show, where Germany and Russia are working together to build a pipeline together. And Russia uses its pipeline as a political weapon to force nations to submit to its will. So this isn't just about economics. This is about Germany really helping prop up Russia. You see them working against, you see them refusing to meet their NATO commitments. You see them working against the United States when it comes to things like internet regulation, doing all they can to take down some of America's biggest companies. You see them working against the United States on issues like Iran, where they're trying to help Iran get around America's economic sanctions. So you look at the NATO alliance 70 years on, and you have to ask, exactly as Donald Trump has, is there even an alliance anymore?
Mm-hmm.
Because Germans don't seem to like being a part of the alliance. Germany's government isn't backing up this alliance. And Germany is rather going in a completely different direction.
But for Germany, it essentially seems to be that they feel like they've gotten all that they need to get from the United States and from their alliance with America.
Right, I think so. And I think, well, I know that this trend is something that's prophesied in the Bible, this shift, this dramatic shift away from Germany propping up the United States, America really looking to Germany in a special way, a close alliance between the two, to then Germany turning against America. And Mr. Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury drew attention to a lot of these prophecies in the cover article that he wrote last autumn, Germany and Russia's Secret War Against America. And he said pretty much exactly that, that Germany feels they've got all they can from the U.S. and that they're ready to move on. He drew attention to, well, a number of prophecies in there. One was in Jeremiah 1 and verse 13. He writes that God shows the prophet a vision of a seething pot, and the face thereof is towards the north. This symbolic language, he writes, is describing modern Germany. Beneath the surface, that nation is full of simmering dissatisfaction with the current world order. Germans are angry at the U.S., especially furious with President Trump. The imperialistic ambition that prompted Germany to start both world wars is alive and well. It is seething. You really see Germany going a different direction to the United States, and really a lot of anger to the United States. When America's ambassador over there reminds Germany, look, you promised, you signed up to this alliance, you signed up to a treaty just a few years ago saying you would spend 2% of your economy by 2024. There's this big outcry about him. There's politicians saying, we need to kick this guy out of the country. Who does he think he is? There's a seething resentment building against the United States in Germany. And Mr. Fleury's article really exposes that, Germany and Russia's secret war against America. It shows what's prophesied for this relationship, and you know, how it just really fits in with the big picture of the Bible.
We'll put a link to that article in the show notes for today's program. And also, we have an article up on the website right now, NATO at 70. Is the alliance finished? Check that out at thetrumpet.com. And thank you very much, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Iran is creating a missile production facility right in Lebanon. That is a warning to the Lebanese coming from America and Israel. For this story, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
So last month, we had Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in Israel meeting with the prime minister. And shortly thereafter, he flew on to Lebanon to meet with the prime minister there and others. And part of the information that he delivered from the Israeli prime minister is that they have received intelligence that Hezbollah, Iran's proxy in Lebanon, is creating or has another precision missile weapons facility, a manufacturing facility in Lebanon. And they've had one of these before. Israel told the world about it, and shortly thereafter it was torn down because Israel threatened to attack it. And this was right near the Beirut International Airport. Now, we don't know where this new one is, but this is basically Israel warning the Lebanese government, saying, you shut it down or we're going to shut it down forcefully. Obviously, Israel can't have precision missile capabilities going onto 150,000 missiles that Hezbollah right now has in its stockpile aimed at Israel, because it couldn't defend themselves from that. And so this is a red line for Israel. They want to ensure that Hezbollah doesn't receive that capability. Now, what's really interesting about this is you have this internal fight going on in Lebanon right now between the Lebanese that don't like Hezbollah's growing hold on the nation, and then those that obviously do want Hezbollah to be in charge. Hezbollah leads right now the largest coalition inside the government. They have a very powerful position. And so here you had Secretary of State Mike Pompeo going up there and saying, hey, Lebanon, watch out. Hezbollah's got all these, you know, missiles preparing to fire them against Israel, and they're building them on your home soil. And then you have Lebanese politicians saying, what do you mean? Hezbollah, they're part of the state. At the same time, you have the United States funding the actual legitimate military of the Lebanese to the tune of over $2 billion in the past decade. And so you have this brewing conflict in Lebanon where you have pro-Iranian elements and also elements that would like Iran gone from the nation. Bible prophecy talks a lot about Lebanon and how it is going to have this internal turmoil in this end time. We know that eventually Lebanon is not going to be ruled by Iran like it is right now. And maybe the increasing pressure the United States is putting on Iran and Hezbollah is going to make the Lebanese see that their future, if they want a stable country, cannot be aligned with Iran. If people want to read more about our longstanding forecast for Lebanon, they can read our editor-in-chief's article, Why You Must Watch Lebanon.
Why You Must Watch Lebanon. We'll put a link to that in the show notes for the program today. Thank you, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Japan's emperor will abdicate at the end of this month, and as is custom, the nation will begin a new era the following day. To learn about this new imperial era and what it may mean for Japan, we'll go back to Anthony Chibatewe.
Yes, like you said, at the beginning of next month, Japan will have a new emperor, and his reign will begin a new era and a new official name for that era. And the Japanese government of Shinzo Abe revealed on Monday that that new name will be Reiwa, which means auspicious calm and harmony. Now, that all sounds great and superb, except that traditionally, the names of these Japanese eras have always been based on Chinese classical literature. Until now. For the first time ever, Japan has broken from tradition that's about 1,400 years old and named this upcoming era based on Japanese literature. Now, people can downplay that. I mean, after all, that's Japan, and it's their emperor, and they can name their heirs however they want. But there are many observers who are expressing a lot of concern that this development is not only emblematic of how much Japan has changed, but also how much Japan will change. One of the characters in the new name is widely thought to mean order or command or dictate. So it has authoritarian tone, and that's getting some people worried about that. But there's also a little bit more to it, that shift from to something more nationalistic. It's very similar to what Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has been championing in Japan. One expert on Imperial Japan told the New York Times that Shinzo Abe's choice for this word for the Japanese era was unquestionably significant. And the Times of London wrote about this and said that the name change reflects the nationalistic pride of its Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. And we know quite a lot about what he has been championing, just trying to move Japan away from its pacifism. There's another article from another expert that said this: with the wartime generation fading fast from the scene, coupled with heightened regional tensions, the circumstances are not nearly as favorable for promoting the agenda of pacifism and reconciliation of the previous emperor over the sanctimonious nationalism that now prevails among Japan's governing elite. And this is a trend that a lot of experts are concerned about, and it's a trend that we at The Trumpet have been watching. We have an article, a trend article, on this very subject. It's titled "Why the Trumpet Watches Japan's March Toward Militarism," and I think this new era is very much in line with this trend of Japan's march toward militarism.
Well, we shall see, shall we not? We thank you very much for that, Anthony. One final story. Democrats in America have been insisting there's no immigration crisis. It's a fake emergency created by the president. But numbers are rolling in that have more and more people saying, actually, the problem is even worse than advertised. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
On Tuesday, the Secretary of Homeland Security made comments that President Donald Trump's administration is treating the illegal immigration crisis at the border as if it were a Category 5 hurricane disaster, and that they're bringing together all agencies. And the numbers actually back that up. The Secretary was not speaking critically in that case. She's was agreeing with the president that it is like a Category 5 hurricane disaster. They've had 76,000 illegals were arrested at the border in February and 100,000 last month. So that's just in the past 2 months. You've got almost 200,000 illegals arrested, which is a huge uptick from what it's been in recent years. Actually, just those 2 months were more arrests than the entirety of 2018. And it actually sets like records in terms of families, or at least people who have children with them crossing the border. In the past, it's primarily been single men trying to get across the border. Now they're having the majority of these arrests have been groups traveling with children. There have been many people have pointed out that since words kind of spread that the United States isn't deporting those with children, the waiting line so long that the laws say you can't keep them more than 90 days, and the waiting line for asylum is so long that you can't process them within 90 days, so they end up just getting let into American society. So they're pretty much any family that wants to come here can take their children, or even some of the more enterprising drug cartels have established rent-a-kid businesses that if you mm-hmm. don't have a kid, you can rent one from them and get in that way.
So the politicians who are saying this really is a massive emergency, obviously just the raw numbers are extremely concerning. Those are going up dramatically. Maybe you could talk about some of the other ripple effects that that this influx of immigrants causes that increase the the troublesome aspect of just what a disaster this is.
Right, because you mentioned, I mean, just raw numbers, having the United States having a hard time to process it. They're talking about bringing all agencies together because they said the end, any given day, they're averaging almost 45,000 immigrants in detention centers waiting some either an asylum claim or a deportation process or whatever they're going to do with them. So that's 45,000 people. 2,000 of those are in quarantine facilities with outbreaks of mumps, chickenpox, or influenza. And that's 2,000 of those they've arrested. It's hard to tell how many others with mumps, chickenpox, or influenza didn't get arrested and are just spreading those three diseases primarily throughout the nation. It's hard to determine the crime levels, but there is definitely, that is a huge significant aspect of this as well. There's some studies that will tell you that illegal immigrants don't commit crimes at a higher rate than native-born citizens, but those studies are focused primarily on the 11 million illegal immigrants in America who are so confident being here that they're willing to put their name on a census form. The Yale studies have indicated that the real number of legal immigrants is probably closer between 16 and 30 million. And so it's hard to say what those other 10 to 20 million illegal immigrants who aren't putting their name on the census form are doing. The Government Accountability Office actually has specific data for murder showing that the people in prisons for murder, there's three times more illegal immigrants in jails for murder than you'd expect if they were committing them at the same rate as the American population in general.
So this is either there are a lot more of them than we think, or they're just a lot more prone to commit murder.
One of the two. There's either they're saying there's 11 million and they're no more likely to commit murder than anyone else, but it's like one or both of those statements is false. But the economic impact is a little easier to measure. They know that cost taxpayers about $116 billion every year. That's in additional law enforcement costs, the health care costs that are going to these 2,000 people with these diseases, the 45,000 yep. 45,000 of the detention centers, and welfare programs. They actually said 89% of households headed by illegal immigrant parents, so almost all of them, use at least one welfare program. Because the majority of illegal immigrants coming here have poor English skills, and large segments of them lack a high school diploma. They're competing with some of the most impoverished and vulnerable Americans for jobs. And they've done studies to indicate that these 11 to 30 million illegal immigrants have depressed the annual wages of Americans without a high school diploma by about $1,500. Which and when you don't have a high school diploma, $1,500 is quite a bit of money. That's probably like close to 10% of what you're making. bringing this back around to prophecy. There's a scripture in Hosea 7 verses 8 and 9 specifically. This says, Ephraim has mixed himself among the people. Ephraim is a cake not turned. Strangers have devoured his strength, and he knows it not. Yea, gray hairs are upon him, and he knows it not. And our founder, Mr. Herbert Armstrong, had written times before this that Ephraim is actually the tribe that settled in Britain, but it was the birthright nation. So this term does kind of encompass both America and Britain, being mixed with foreigners who particularly are devouring their strength and they know it not, which is what you're seeing in America today. Your economic and societal strength is being devoured by out of control immigration, foreigners pouring into the border, and yet the media knows it not.
And so many politicians as well. Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com, and we'll give you links to all the articles and the literature that we discussed today. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to this group of distinguished gentlemen, Andrew Miller, Anthony Chibatawe, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
It's an honor to be here.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Folk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of John Arbuthnot. All political parties die at last of swallowing their own lies. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.